And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Arnie Sherman, a good Sunday morning.
Good morning to you, Scott. It's always good to catch up with you on what's been going on. We're going to today talk about something that's been happening over the last week, since a week ago Saturday, which was the Amtrak rail problem, the derailment of the Amtrak train from Chicago to the West Coast, and bringing back one of our favorite guests, Peter Goltz, who's former head of National Transportation Safety Board in Washington, insider and lobbyist, and we'll talk about what's happened with Amtrak and where things are, at least at this point in time, and then maybe talk more generally about infrastructure in the U.S. and Washington being at loggerheads, and where we stand as a country as we try to move forward on lots of issues that the public has general agreement on. The public generally agrees, by and large, that everybody on COVID vaccination, we agree in general by a large margin that we need infrastructure investment, but these things just don't seem to get done for political reasons. And we're going to ask Peter a little bit about take the current temperature of what's going on in our nation's capital.
Yeah, we were so fortunate to be able to have somebody of Peter's stature and his experience on our airwaves. So this is going to be a great conversation, Arnie. I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, I am as well.
Okay, back after this with our guest, Peter Goltz.
Young people everywhere are making a difference.
Special Olympics has changed my life so dramatically.
It's helped me a lot to be fearless, in the real world.
My friends I've made through Special Olympics are the best people I've ever met in my life.
I truly realize that what I'm doing is for a great cause.
And it's not about disabilities, but it's about celebrating their abilities.
I've made a difference. Now it's your turn to make a difference.
Get involved at SpecialOlympics.org.
At the YMCA, people are the foundation of who we are and who we have been for nearly 170 years. You are the Y. And even though the Y may look a little different right now, our commitment to you remains as strong as ever. So stay with us. Stay connected with your Y. Stay connected with each other. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
You don't need to run all over the field fumbling around for all your party beverages. Just huddle up at Lolo Liquor and Wine. The perfect call is a stop at Lolo Liquor and Wine for a huge assortment of liquor, wine, and mixers. That includes a great selection of tasty canned cocktails that don't need mixing. Also, lots of wines in the can. Locally owned Lolo Liquor and Wine, open Mondays through Saturdays in the Lolo Shopping Center. And visit LoloLiquorAndWine.com.
Unused prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble. They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for. Harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet. Or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community, at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
Keep hundreds of dollars a month in wages in your pocket. At Pyramid Mountain Lumber, there is no out-of-pocket insurance premium cost for employees and their dependents. And Pyramid is offering a $500 hiring bonus. Entry-level positions with no experience necessary start at $17.40 an hour. Skilled positions up to $28.50 per hour. Great wages and great benefits with a family-run, locally-owned company. Multiple positions available. Applications online at PyramidLumber.com or call or stop by the office in Cedar Lake. Every weekend, Diane Beck of Windermere Real Estate presents Missoula Real Estate Today on News Talk KGVO. Diane and her guests provide interesting information about the local housing market, along with industry-related topics and trends. Missoula Real Estate Today, presented by Diane Beck of Windermere Real Estate, Saturday mornings from 8 till 8:30, and again Sunday mornings from 10:30 till 11 on News Talk KGVO, FM 98.3 and AM 1290.
Are you turning 65 soon or have already passed that milestone? When you work with an independent insurance agent, you should pick your insurance plan that fits your needs. This is Cody Steele. For 21 years, Cody Steele Agency has been specializing in your secondary coverage to Medicare for Western Montanans. Representing 23 companies allows me to provide you with many plans and coverage that you may be looking for. And that includes life insurance and fixed annuities. Find out and set up an appointment with me today, CodySteeleAgency.com. That's Steele with an E on the end. And let me help you choose the best plan for your golden years.
Arnie, we are back with our guest, the Washington lobbyist, insider, and former head of the NTSB, Peter Gulch. Peter, welcome.
Good to be with you guys.
Peter, it's always a pleasure to chat with you about current events. And there's nothing more current in Montana at the moment, even though this may air later in the week, is the Amtrak derailment in North Central or Northwest rural Montana. I mean, near a town of 200 people, an Amtrak train with 141 people on board and 16 crew went off the track. I think there's a 10 cars. I think 8 of them turned over. There are 3 people that have been died and 50 people injured. How does that happen?
Well, we'll find out. And I think we'll find out fairly quickly. You know, railroads are kind of old-fashioned infrastructure, so there's not a lot of rocket science. And there's a lot of information that the investigators will be able to get from the event recorders on the train, the forward-looking camera that's on the train, the forward-looking camera on trains that have passed over that site previously. My understanding is that a second train had passed over that site less than an hour before, and they'll look at that tape very carefully. So I think that we'll get a pretty good handle on what happened to this fairly quickly.
You know, you spent a number of years leading the National Transportation Safety Board. So what do they do when they get on site? They're going to show up in rural, Montana. There have been people at the site already. Any local responders who've tried to help out and all that. What's the first thing that the NTSB people do when they get there?
Well, luckily there was an NTSB rail investigator living in Montana, working remotely. So he was able to get to the scene very quickly within, I think, 6 or 7 hours. And generally what they try to do is lock down the site and preserve evidence and document everything they can. Because, there's pressure from the railroad, from BNSF, to get the line open as quickly as possible. The High Line is a heavily traveled rail line, primarily agricultural goods and stuff. So they want to get the wreckage pushed aside and cleared up and back on. But the first activities are to lock down the evidence. Let's see what we got here. Get photographs of it, videotapes of it, and see what we got.
So it's been described that derailment is like extreme turbulence in an airplane. Has that been your experience for cars that go off the track and turn on their side, like some of these did?
Well, sure. You're dealing with the laws of physics, and those rail cars and engines. I think the engine's probably 80 tons. So when something that size, gets into an accident and has to stop suddenly, it plows up a lot of territory, but it throws a lot of power off, a lot of energy off, and people get thrown around quite violently. And one of the things that designers do is they try and design the interior of rail cars with that in mind, so that there aren't a lot of sharp edges and corners to beat you up if you get into a wreck. But they'll investigate that fairly closely.
Well, the Amtrak Empire Builder, that's what this train was, has sleeper cars on it. And there were people on the train taking naps or sleeping at that time. That must have been a surprising and shocking experience for them.
Well, you probably ended up on the roof, at least. And, right, the Empire builder, maybe 100 miles further west from the accident site, splits into two trains. You know, one continues up to Seattle, the other with a couple of cars heads down to Portland. But it's a beautiful line, and it usually has a pretty good number of people on it.
And I assume that's why it has two engines attached, because it splits.
Well, it's got to climb. It's got to climb some grades on the line, and it's a popular line. And this accident apparently took place right at or just prior to a turnoff. You know, it's a single track, but they have turnoffs periodically so that faster or higher priority trains can continue on the track, and the slower or less priority trains pull off onto a siding and then rejoin the main line. I think they'll look closely at that switch to make sure, you know, that it was operating correctly. It's controlled remotely, from down in Texas. It's probably not an issue of speed, because BNSF has positive train control in that section of the line. So I'm sure the speed will probably not be a factor. They're going to be looking. Go ahead.
I was going to say, some of the passengers said that the train felt bumpy for many miles. Would that be indicative of a suspension problem, maybe?
Well, it could. I wouldn't say a suspension, but they'll look at three main areas. You know, they'll look at the track and the switching to make sure that the track didn't fail. It had been inspected just a few days before, last Thursday, and then they'll look at the rail cars themselves to make sure that the wheels were and the carriages were functioning properly. Sometimes the wheels can overheat, they can crack, but you know, there are detection devices that are supposed to pick that up. So,
Peter, are you surprised that there aren't more accidents on some of these train lines?
Well, you know, this is the last Amtrak accident was back in 2017. In Washington State, there was one that was on its inaugural run, and it was a speed issue. And prior to that, there was two or three of them in the 2015-2016 area.
In Philadelphia, I remember there was one.
There were two there, and Amtrak was heavily criticized that they had slipped in their commitment to safety. But since that time, I think they've been doing a pretty good job. And this is only the second accident in 5 years. And, I think that's a pretty good record.
Got it. Well, you know, there could be equipment problem, as you said. There could be, I suppose that, you know, there could be buckling of track, even though somebody had inspected it a little earlier. It's been hot and cold in Montana, where it's been up to the 90s, you know, there, and then down in the 30s at night. I mean, who knows? But it brings up a bigger question, which is the state of infrastructure in general in the United States. I mean, you and I, Peter and Scott, have traveled abroad and have seen in Asia, in Europe, these beautiful highways and, you know, state-of-the-art bridges and, wonderful on-time train stations with high-speed trains. And then you drive through parts of the United States and it'll look like 1950s. So
yeah, there is no question that the status of infrastructure, whether it's the rail, the inner-city rail service, whether it's bridges, and overpasses, is just in an appalling state. And we have ignored rail for decades or longer. I mean, the Europeans have such a superior system throughout Europe and the UK, in which the and in the Far East, China and Japan both have superior inner city rail systems. I mean, the idea that it still takes, you know, 2 hours and 40 minutes to get from Washington to New York City is just outrageous. And, you know, if we don't make investments in these kinds of infrastructure, we're going to fall further and further behind. And it's an embarrassment. And I hope the Congress gets to address it in the next couple of weeks. I'm doubtful, but I hope they will.
And why are you doubtful, and why haven't we done it? I mean, from your perspective, inside the Beltway, what's going on there?
Well, you know, we are such a partisan country now. Now, if anyone thinks the other side, you know, if the Republican thinks that President Biden is going to score some points with a significant investment in infrastructure, no matter how much it's needed, they're going to oppose it. I mean, the idea Republicans would not be supporting the expansion of high speed internet in rural America is beyond me. I mean, the idea I drove from Washington to Annapolis, which is not going through any part of rural America last week, and my phone dropped calls three separate times. Because it wasn't the signal strength from Verizon wasn't, and I was on an interstate. I mean, the idea that this country is in such pathetic shape, and that it's not being addressed is really an outrage.
And no matter what happens, even if we have an accident like that, it doesn't seem to get them any more energized in Washington. This notion of, you know, of bringing people together and all that kind of stuff just doesn't seem to have materialized.
No, there's no bringing anyone together at this point. I mean, we are at each other's throats, and and really at the core of it is Donald Trump and his continuing opposition to virtually anything of a positive nature in Washington. You know, his control over the Republican Party is absolute, and they are going to sink or swim with him at the head. And, you know, the idea that Mitch McConnell, who comes from, you know, the state of Kentucky, which outside of the bluegrass country is really poor. The idea that he is not fighting for a greater investment in rural America is beyond me.
How do you explain Joe Manchin then, who is a Democrat in also a poor state? And boy, he really toes the line and is kind of skating right up the middle when he could, in fact, be such a deciding factor to say we need to move forward and adopt
He's either the 49th or the 50th vote for the Democrats. And, you know, he takes a look at the demographics of West Virginia, and they voted overwhelmingly for Trump. They are still very much supportive of Trump. He is not a guy of the greatest political courage. He apparently wants to be reelected, and he's going to kowtow to that. I mean, here we have, I mean, West Virginia is getting walloped by the COVID pandemic again. And, there's, in case anyone doesn't know it, there's not a lot of health care in rural West Virginia. And people are dying. And it's because they're not vaccinated. And they're not vaccinated because they haven't been convinced that the vaccine actually will save their lives. And it's really quite distressing.
Let me flip to another issue. You talk about COVID, and it brings up airline travel and consumer activities in the transportation sector. How has the airline industry responded? Do you think they've done a good job? Do you think they're on the right path? Do you think they've done enough?
Well, I do some work, you know, for the flight attendants of American Airlines. So I've been involved in this fight from the beginning. And I have to say, you know, that the airline industry a year and a half ago was at the verge of complete and utter collapse. And it has been salvaged. The reality is that they're doing as good a job as they can right now. You know, a lot of personnel took early retirement or took buyouts. So there's not a lot of give in the system. You know, for instance, in flight attendants, you know, they work 10 hours a day. They can be held for longer than that if the planes are delayed. But there's not a lot of reserve crew anymore, and which means that you know, if there's a weather incident, if there's a mechanical problem, and it throws a monkey wrench into the system. Same thing is true for pilots, and the reality is the same thing is true for equipment. There just isn't a lot of give in the system, but the reality is I think they've done a pretty good job. And if people wear their masks when they get on the plane, which apparently some people find that offensive, they'll be pretty safe. They'll get off the plane with a very low chance of picking up the COVID
Delta variant.
If you follow the rules.
I was on a flight recently where they escorted a family off the plane. I'm not sure how they got on the plane because you're supposed to be wearing your mask, but they refused to wear their mask on religious grounds during the flight, and they had to bring a marshal on. And then, you know, ultimately they finally had to escort them off the plane. You know, it was not violent or anything. It was peaceful. And we had to wait till their luggage came off. And so 100 people were inconvenienced, you know, and delayed several hours as a result of, you know, some folks just saying it was their right not to wear a mask.
Well, and if they don't want to wear a mask, drive.
Yeah.
You know, and that's
easy. I don't see it any different than wearing a seatbelt.
Wearing a seatbelt or being in some states require wearing a helmet. It's not any different than requiring drivers to have insurance. You know, it's a mark of responsibility for the rest of society. And if people don't want to do it, then don't get on the plane in the first place.
Right. Stay off. Peter, you know, talk a little more about what it is like in, you know, in Asia and in Europe and in different parts of the world where there's more sophisticated infrastructure vis-a-vis transportation, connectivity. Like, can you kind of illustrate really the disparity of what we have versus what they have?
Well, I know I've driven, I've traveled extensively in Europe, a little bit in Asia, but extensively in Europe. And the point is you get, if I would, 2 years ago before the pandemic started, I took a trip to Normandy because my father had landed on D-Day, and I was in Paris, and my wife and I, we were going to take the train to Cannes, and we had, which is about a 2 hour train ride. We had four or five different selections over a 5 hour period. You know, we could take a high speed train that would get there in 45 minutes. We could take at one great. We could take a slower train that would get there in an hour and 45. And the trains were clean. They were on time. They gave you a variety of service options in Spain. Traveling between the major cities, you know, whether it's Barcelona or Seville or Madrid, the high-speed trains run multiple times a day at a reasonable cost, and there is really no comparison to public transportation in Europe to the United States, and it's an embarrassment.
And these are cleaner modes of transportation too, correct? So you're not burning fossil fuels to get from point A to point B.
Yeah. And you know, railways, rail lines save a tremendous amount of fossil fuels.
Yeah. You know, last time I was in China, I took the bullet train from Beijing to Shanghai. It's 800 miles. It cost $81 and it took 4 hours to go 800 miles on the train.
Spectacular.
Yeah, here it takes what, 12 hours, 14 hours to go 800 miles, to go 800 miles?
Well, it goes over, it takes over 4 hours to get from Boston to New York, and that's 230 miles.
So have we deprioritized rail travel in favor of air travel as a country?
I think we deprioritized it, not just for air travel, but for automobiles.
Right.
Now, this is really, you know, the creation of the interstate system back in the 50s. I mean, that's where our priority was, and that's where we subsidized, and that's where we put the money into.
So we've always had this sense of individualism, and so being in your car by yourself with your family is preferable to being in a group, right? I mean, it's still rearing its ugly head. We can't get past this individualism that it may not be good for us, but we do it anyway.
Yeah, I think that's part of it.
I mean, it certainly has been one of the most spectacular marketing campaigns of all time to convince Americans that in order to be, you know, prosperous, successful, whatever, you have to have one, two, or three $40,000-$50,000 vehicles at your personal, disposal, when public transportation is much cheaper. Even in Missoula, as you know, Scott, the bus system is free.
Right. It's free.
It's free. And people hardly use it, you know.
Yep. And that's now true in D.C., in Washington. The cost for public transportation in Alexandria, the buses are free and people don't use them. And they're reducing the fares on the Washington Metro to try and stimulate a resurge in passenger ridership.
And it costs a lot, not only for gas and all that, but the parking in Washington, D.C. and other big cities is extraordinarily high for a day.
Well, you think that would discourage people.
Yeah.
But the real issue is the carbon. I mean, is the production of carbon into the atmosphere that is, you know, just destroying our way of life.
Well, related, are you feeling hopeful about how we're trying to convert to electric vehicles? And, you know, each year another, you know, line of vehicles comes out and the big, you know, manufacturers are making a big push. How are you feeling about that?
Scott, the reality is it's too little, too late. And, you know, there was a pretty in-depth article last week showing how the climate change is affecting migrant patterns, that there are terrible droughts not only in our Southwest but throughout North and South America. That we've noticed here in D.C. That the storm intensities are more frequent and more heavy. I mean, boy, when it rains here, it rains. And it was never like that, and it's been documented that this has been an extraordinary change in our weather patterns, and there are species of plants and flowers that are gone now, not to return.
And interesting, publicly, Space Force, and then privately, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and other, in the race to go to Mars and colonize other planets, they're willing to spend more money on getting to another planet than fixing the one they already live on.
Yeah, well, it's hard political decisions, and it's speaking a hard truth. You know, the idea that to be a public official and to look at the history of your own history of where maybe you were mocking climate change 15 or 20 years ago. I mean, how can you look yourself in the mirror? What kind of future are we leaving for our children? I mean, it is a really challenging time.
I've talked to four or five 20-somethings, not just in Missoula, but around the country, who are not going to have children because they're afraid of what the future is going to hold.
Well,
the personal decision that they might not be able to change the future but they don't want their kids to, you know, be at risk. On the other hand, I've heard other people who really believe that all this stuff, science is going to be able to fix it somehow. You know, I remember that one line from the movie The Martian, you know, where he says, I'm going to science the hell out of this and be able to get. They think somehow 20 years from now, 10 years from now, when, you know, when the stuff is out of control, there's going to be some kind of scientific miracle to fix it all. And that's not going to be the case.
That's a hell of a bet to make. And yeah. with enormously high stakes. And, you know, as you know, they may be able to mitigate some of the effects, but the idea that there's going to be some silver bullet invention that's going to say, oh, look what we got. We're on, you know, we're on easy street. Not going to happen.
Yeah, it's like the way they fix cigarettes with putting filters on them.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Exactly. But that was the miracle cure.
You know, what, one thing you said, Arnie, is right. I mean, this is the first generation, you know, of kids now where it's not likely that they'll have a better life than their parents.
Sure.
You know, when we were growing up, and Scott, when you were growing up, we assumed and our parents assumed that we were going to have a better life than they had. You know, right. That's not the case anymore. And that is a terrible thing to think about.
It really is. It really
is. Lots of the, not only are the priorities out of whack, but the cost structure is out of whack. I was just talking to someone today, in fact, who said, talked about buying a car and they can't afford one. And I said, you know, when I was making $20,000 a year, a car was $3,000.
Right.
Now, somebody making that same job, maybe they pay $60,000 now, but that car is $40,000.
Right.
You know, 13, 14 times the price comparatively. And, and we all know the difference in disparity between average workers and CEO salaries have, you know, have gone up hundreds and hundreds of times what they used to be. I have a good friend whose father was in the 60s, was the president and CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and his salary was $50,000 a year. And they live very nicely on it. That job now pays $5 million a year. And the workers in the factory then were making about $25 an hour. They're only making about $35 now. So there really has been, you know, all of that's going on at the same time. You know, we're trying to grapple with, you know, what are the effects of all this and who's going to be most affected by it.
Let's do a quick ID. Our guest is Peter Goltz. He is the former head of the NTSB and Washington insider, lobbyist, and frequent guest on What Do You Know? Peter, do you have any hope that with everything kind of coming together at one time, climate change, infrastructure weakness, and, you know, the next generation of folks kind of opting not to start families, that there could be some type of sea change in policy and how we govern as a country? Because if we keep going in this direction, we're going to crash, right?
It's interesting, Scott. I would encourage people to read a rather lengthy article in Sunday's Washington Post by a guy named Bob Kagan, who's been on their editorial board for years, and this is a real tome on his fear for the future. And from his perspective, and he's been a smart guy and a reasonable guy and a balanced guy for 30 years, his view is that we are really as a country facing a precipice and that we're teetering. And I think we have some very hard choices to make in the next 3 years. A lot of them will be in the election of 2022, and then more importantly in the election of 2024. And that we just people need to think this one through very carefully, because we are. And as you say, Bob Kagan's article is a must read if you're concerned about where we're headed.
I'm going to read that. You know, for both of you, since you've traveled extensively internationally, what's the version of the dye-in-the-wool, red, you know, conservative, uneducated person in Spain look like, or in Italy look like, or in China look like? You know, they don't have a voice in those countries because they are uneducated and poor. But yeah. Here, this group en masse seems to marshal one individual, and they have a big voice.
Well, there's a couple of things, you know, about that. One is they have a vehicle to magnify, you know, it's like a megaphone, which is Fox News, you know, and making some of the issues and some of the support of those issues to be a lot larger than it may really be. I mean, sure. We've talked about this before, and Peter knows this because he's an astute student of history. But a majority of Americans in the Revolutionary War supported the British. You know, right. They didn't support the independence of the United States. A few months before World War II, 80%+ of Americans were against entering the war. Arguably, the most popular president, of the last 100 years or so was Franklin Roosevelt. He got elected 4 times. It's still the best election he had. Still, 40% of the people voted against him. I mean, he saved us from the Great Depression. He did all that stuff. This country has always had a split. The difference has been that majority has generally ruled, and the minority, you know, position had not been escalated to a point that it was equal or greater than the majority position. It turned around with Ronald Reagan when your famous silent majority. Right. It was never a majority. That was a good phrase to coin, you know, and now we have a situation here where many of the people who are, you know, anti-science, you know, take a contrarian position no matter what, you know, scream out against the government that they rely on for food stamps and for all these other services. They turn, you know, it's become a very polarized, as Peter said, position, and one that makes it almost impossible to govern in a positive way. I don't know what your thoughts are, Peter.
Well, no, you can't. I mean, politicians do not get rewarded by making compromises. And, you know, and all the things you mentioned, Arnie, are all true. And then you have the issue, the undercurrent of race, which is really a poisonous history in our country. And you know, we've never acknowledged it. We've glossed over it. We've refused to acknowledge the inherent privilege that comes with being white, and that is an overlay that is very hard to get away from. You know, in Alexandria, and Arnie, you lived in Alexandria. You know, it's arguably one of the most beautiful towns. In the mid-Atlantic, it is gorgeous. It has a very upbeat, approach to its history. And unfortunately, it's wrong. It was the second largest, area of slave importation. And they had some of the largest slave auctions in the country outside of Richmond and New Orleans in Alexandria. As late as the turn of the century in 1900, we had two individuals that were lynched right on Main Street in Alexandria, King and Cameron. And they were left hanging there for days. And it's just, you know, we can't underestimate the appalling, influence that racial prejudice has had on our country's history and on our history today.
I mean, just recently, you know, Tucker Carlson was peddling a conspiracy theory that we're trying to replace legacy Americans, which means white Americans, with more obedient people from faraway countries. And it's been endorsed by people like my, you know, Matt Gaetz and other congressmen. I mean, they're taking this kind of stuff seriously. You know, it's crazy.
Well, remember, you know, you mentioned Franklin Roosevelt, you know, in the late 30s and early 40s before Pearl Harbor, the Nazi Bund packed over 20,000 people into Madison Square Garden. And a lot of people felt that Charles Lindbergh, you know, had he run in 1940, could have beaten Roosevelt.
And he was a Nazi sympathizer.
Well, he was certainly sympathetic. Yes, you know, and, you know, one of the great things about Lindbergh that people, you know, it's just to show how history gets written and then doesn't get written. He was, married to Anne Morrow Lindbergh, who was a wonderful author in her own right and a figure in her own right. And after Lindbergh died, it was revealed that he had not one, not two, but three complete families that he was married to in Germany with children. And, of course, nobody believed it until they did the DNA testing. And he had a number of kids. And he had gotten married again and again in Europe after the war. Kind of an
it all goes back to it. You can blame air travel on that.
Well, you blame something on it. Just,
God.
I think the race issue is an issue, and it raises a lot of hackles on people on both, you know, on any part of the political, you know, spectrum. You know, the whole thing of Black Lives Matter, you know, versus All Lives Matter. I mean, they're not equal in terms of what they mean and what they represent and what they speak about. But it's very easy in this era where everybody thinks of themselves as an expert on a topic because they've done research, you know, and the research is, you know, looking up one article or two articles that appears on your favorite, you know, website of choice. It just makes it much more difficult to have any kind of consensus building. I mean, how do you build consensus on anything?
You can't. There's no such thing as consensus anymore. You know, and that's the problem. You know, and we're split down the middle, and it's going to stay that way for the immediate future.
Well, what's interesting about saying it's split down the middle? There's an argument that could be made that says the middle is disproportionately weighed because of the way the United States Senate is set up, where every state gets two senators, regardless of how many people are in the state. We have two senators in Montana. We have 1 million people. California has 47 million people and has two senators, you know, and so you got the whole South. And, you know, Peter, as again, as a historian, that was partially done, you know, back, you know, prior to the Civil War, in order to appease the South and to keep slavery, you know, as part of the American landscape.
Yeah, the economy was based on it. 3/5, you know, they needed to have a balance against the what they viewed as the tyranny of the urban North. You know, and we've paid a price for that ever since.
Is there any?
You know, if you look back, you know, the myths that we have. One of the great unveilings in the past year and a half has been the myth of the glorious South. You know, and the idea there was an article written just a couple of weeks ago by the head of the history department of West Point, who said that not only was General Lee a lousy general, you know, and a miserable human being in the way that he treated his own slaves and stuff, but that he threw away tens of thousands of lives through faulty military decisions. And, you know, God, it caused an outcry. You know, how could we be you know, picking on the great glorious reputation of General Lee as a lousy strategic thinker, besides being a miserable human being?
Is there any foreign, both of you, question to both of you, who's doing, who's governing and creating policy well in the Western kind of world, right? Is the United Kingdom doing any better, or Germany? Everyone's kind of...
Well, there's an election in
Germany.
Germany, and it looks like a new coalition government's going to be built, you know, not with Merkel's party as the lead party.
Right.
The Social Democrats won that.
Here's my bucket list for the day. Read an article on a new subject. Say only nice things about others. And listen to everyone's opinions. Because making things better requires change. Now, these changes aren't going to show up on your news feed, but they're things I can do. So change something today. It's not going to change the entire world, but it's going to change your world. Change is in you. Pass it on. From PassItOn.com.
Get the latest on Grizzly football with the head coach every Wednesday. It's the Grizzly Football Coaches Show, live from Finn inside the DoubleTree Hotel. Head coach Bobby Hogg joins the voice of the Grizz, Riley Corcoran, to recap the last game and look ahead to the next opponent. Join us live at Finn inside the DoubleTree. But if you can't make it, you can catch it on the radio. The Grizzly Football Coaches Show, 6:30 to 7:30 Wednesday evenings on News Talk KGVO FM 98.3 and AM 1290, and in Hamilton on 1240 KLYQ.
Has your child swallowed your medicine, your laundry detergent, your nail polish remover? Call the Poison Helpline. Have you inhaled paint thinner, glue, pesticides? Call the Poison Helpline. Have a question about adults, a fume, something your kid just drank? Call the Poison Helpline. Poisonings can happen at the home, on the job, or in the great outdoors. Call the Poison Helpline first for fast, free advice from medical professionals. Call 1-800-222-1222 anytime, anywhere. 1-800-222-1222. Save the number, save a life. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
My big sister Jenna's face turned bright red. She was just showing people online how to use a new cream. She still has the scars.
Real products are tested for safety. My brother's friend Billy had to jump off his motor scooter when it caught fire. He fell and got hit by a car. Blew his chances to play basketball in college.
Go for real.
Visit ncpc.org/goforreal. Brought to you by the National Crime Prevention Council and the United States Patent and Trademark Office.
I've been driving trucks for a long time. Safety is my number one priority. I know that my truck has huge blind spots. That's why I remember to check my mirrors often for smaller vehicles. Everyone can help keep our roads safe. Next time you're behind the wheel, try to avoid lingering in those blind spots. It can be dangerous. Let's all plan to share the road safely. Learn how at www.sharetheroadsafely.gov.
For breakfast, lunch, and dinner, find yourself in paradise. Paradise Falls starts serving at 7 a.m. daily, featuring all your traditional breakfast favorites as well as Paradise Falls specialty items. For lunch and dinner, there's a full menu of burgers, steaks, sandwiches, pizzas, salads, and lots of other Falls favorites. And sports fans love all the TVs to watch the NFL, Montana Grizzly teams, a selection of local high school games, and more. Family-friendly Paradise Falls, open 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. every day. 3621 Brooks in Missoula.
There are a ton of social networking websites, but one stands apart for a very special reason. This one saves lives. It's MatchingDonors.com. MatchingDonors.com links organ donors with people in need of kidney and other transplants. In the U.S., 22 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. If you've ever considered becoming a living organ donor, or if you're someone in need of an organ transplant, visit MatchingDonors.com, home of the greatest gift of all, the gift of life. MatchingDonors.com.
More and more Missoula area residents are asking for a lower cost, simple cremation option. Just Cremation Montana is the answer. Local, compassionate, and experienced, with a commitment to provide dignified cremation options at the lowest price. For families who just want cremation or additional services, Just Cremation Montana's licensed funeral directors and support staff can assist your family during one of the most difficult times in your life. Visit justcremationmt.com. That's justcremationmt.com.
Did you know there are laws that protect the health and safety rights of agriculture workers? And if you or a loved one is dealing with coronavirus, your rights may include required details about your job and pay, payment at the proper rate for every hour you work, safe transportation, and safe and clean housing. For more information and free help, call 866-4-US-WAGE or visit worker.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Labor.
All right, Arnie, we are back with our guest, Peter Goltz.
So looping back to our original story about the Amtrak problem here, let's assume they figure out what happened and they fix it. What happens after that? What generally happens?
Well, what happens is the investigators, they'll start giving daily briefings on scene for the next 5 or 6 days, and then they'll wrap it up and go home to D.C. They'll take with them pieces of the track, pieces of the wheel. If there was a wheel problem, they'll take.
Is there a black box on the train?
Yes, there are. There's an event recorder. It's not as comprehensive or as complex as a aviation black box. On a Boeing or an Airbus, they can monitor 300 plus different parameters of the aircraft. But this will give you speed, direction, braking, that sort of thing. It's indestructible. So I'm sure it's in good shape. They'll look at the event recorders. They'll interview the crews. And as I say, they'll look at the front end camera of both this train and any other trains that were passing in the area. And I think we'll have a pretty good picture pretty quickly on what happened.
Thank you, Peter, for your insider perspective. We don't always get this kind of information about how these things unfold and what happens and all that. We appreciate hearing it from you.
All right. Happy to be here.
Thank you again, Peter. We appreciate it. All right, Arnie, I will see you next week.
See you next week, Scott. Take care.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO,